Welcome to the Italian Renaissance Podcast, where we discuss the culture and art of 15th and 16th century Italy. I'm your host, Lawrence Ginangeli. Andiamo avanti. Renaissance people, welcome back to the podcast and part two of my interview with art historian and teacher Frank Nero. Nero is about to take us on a journey to San Martino del Vescovo. If you have not watched part one of the interview, I suggest you do so, but this content can stand alone. You're about to experience a lecture of an obscure location in Florence, featuring Ghirlandaio's frescoes and his workshop, as well as some very interesting and quirky history of the Medici and the upper class in Florence in the 1400s. Renaissance people, Frank Nero.
So I know that you have taught thousands of students on site.
I'd say so, yes.
And I know that you have a very good reputation among the years of students that you've taught. So I asked you to think about, sort of in light of what we've been talking about, a place in Florence that's not the Uffizi, that's not where you have to, you know, swing your way through a crowd, but that really speak to the objectives of an art historian that is real, and also that's fulfilling to teach in. And I think your former students listening and people who have never encountered you before are going to be delighted to depart on an art history adventure with you. So what you chose for us is this small little, what do we call it? It's like a chapel or...
It's an oratory.
Oratory of San Martino del Vescovo in Florence. And I'm just going to let you, you know, talk about the space, why it's really actually important for the study of Florentine Renaissance art or Renaissance or Florentine history, but also to like walk through the fresco cycle and learn some really fascinating history.
So one of the strategies to survival strategies, I guess, when you're teaching an art history course in Florence, so do a lot of legwork, because you're going to need a break and your students are going to need a break from the crowds and the frustrations, everything that comes along with mass tourism. And there are places like that still to discover in the city. I mean, if you're new, take out a guidebook. But if you're an old hand, especially with a vast intellectual knowledge of the Renaissance in Florence, you'll probably know some of these sites. Sometimes they could be free. A lot of times they have weird opening times, so you'd have to be aware of that. They're not in art historical canon, so a lot of times tour guides won't go there, or if they do, they'll only stop for a brief moment to take a little peek in and then head on to the next thing, or to lunch usually. And this is one of them. And it's really in the heart of the north side of Florence, north side of the Arno, steps from the Duomo, steps from the Or San Michele, really close to the Casa di Dante, the replica of Dante's house, tucked into this small little piazzetta, this little piazza. And it used to be attached to a much grander structure, actually the Church of San Martino, that I believe was razed to the ground perhaps in the 16 or 1700s, but they left this oratory standing and has a really interesting history where you could get into Medici politics, the Medici family, the great artists associated with the high point of the Quattrocento of the 15th century in Florence, Ghirlandaio, of course, being one of the names that's high up in the canon, but also gives you a little, you know, look inside of something that's different than your standard religious paintings or your mythological paintings, and may even in a way make the Renaissance more human when approaching a space like this. And this isn't the only one, but this is the one that I chose. So, as many of you guys may know, in 1434, Cosimo il Vecchio, Cosimo de' Medici, came back from exile, after being expelled by the Strozzi and Albizzi family. It wasn't in exile for long. And when he came back, story too long to tell here, but when he came back, he had many things sort of weighing on his conscience, on his soul. And a lot of art historians talk about Cosimo then getting together with the Archbishop of Florence at the time, Sant'Antonino, Antonio Pierozzi. You know, that led to Cosimo's commissioning of Fra Angelico as San Marco and the renovation of that whole complex. And Cosimo doing a lot of things in the city to alleviate real politics that he had to institute, like changing the Florentine constitution. It became less, it was a republic only in name, and really everything ran through the Medici Palace, of course. So that was really sort of revolutionary in the city at the time. Anyway, there was a class of people in Florence who were connected to the great age-old, wealthy, and politically significant Florentine families who were exiled by the Medici. Usually they were the senior citizens of the clans, the infants, many of the females. Of course, one of the classic books during this period is a woman of the Strozzi family writing letters to her, I think it's Alessandro degli Strozzi. I don't know why I'm having a mental block right now, but writing these letters to her son, who's in exile in Naples, giving her, you know, all the updates about what's happening in Florence and how much the family is struggling without the patriarchs. So there was this whole class of people that were of elite status in the city, but obviously they had fallen on hard times, very difficult times. Basically, Cosimo de' Medici excluded them from the political and economic life of the city in retribution for his own exile and for the establishment of his sort of supremacy in the city. So one of the things that he formulated, being advised by this religious advisor, this Dominican Sant'Antonino, was to help this, you know, there was God's poor. There was, you know, the disabled, the blind, the beggars, the, you know, people who are perpetually poor in the lower classes of the city, the monks, all different classes of poor. And this was sort of a new class of poor that had arisen in the city, that Cosimo de' Medici had a hand in creating himself. And what happened was that these people, because of their high status, they were given the appellation, the name of I poveri vergognosi. I guess a way to translate that would be the ashamed poor or the shame-faced poor, who, you know, they refused to take handouts. They refused to go into the city and beg, you know, for their clothing, for the wood to keep their stoves and fireplaces going, for basic foodstuffs. So these families were basically on the verge of a calamity. And of course, that would redound poorly to Cosimo's new rule in the city, especially that they weren't sort of politically active males. So he decided to build this confraternity. They're called the 12 Good Men, I Buon Uomini. And they were dedicated to St. Martin, who became their patron saint. And St. Martin was the patron saint of charity givers. And of course, there was a church already consecrated to St. Martin. So they connected this oratory to it. And what it was 12 anonymous men who would dress in blue and red robes and disguise their identity. But also, you could see who you knew that the confraternity was on the move because of their robes. And they would go out and collect donations and try to convince people to make donations to St. Martin in their last wills and testaments. On feast days, they would get barrels of wine and wheat and There may have been even an oven on this site, and a lot of documents attest to how they would then anonymously keep this class of people afloat and give them sustenance. Another great worry for the Florentines, especially of that status, was the status of their single women. Without having money for a trousseau or dowries, this was a stain on the collective, soul of the city, that possibly women of this high standing could, if not fall into prostitution, at least be labeled in something, less than pure. A lot of scholars talk about how women in Renaissance Florence, once they reached a certain age, they only had a single identity, and that was to be married, whether it be to obviously a groom or whether it be to Christ. So this was something that was very important, is how are we going to provide the dowries for these young women through no fault of their own? We're in these precarious social situations. So you can even see on the front of the oratory today, of course, it's been remodeled over the centuries very much. You can see in the lower right-hand corner there, sort of plaque, and you can see a cross with a slit in it. You can actually come by and drop coins in there. Even today, I think the confraternity is actually still in existence today. And you could drop some donations, some alms in there. And there's the plaque below it saying, if you give charity at this spot to the 12 good men, you'll receive so many years out of purgatory. So it actually got a official declaration by the Pope to serve in that manner. So it was probably formed by Cosimo de' Medici sometime in the 1430s, 1440s. Probably the building of the oratory came around that time or shortly thereafter. Cosimo's grandsons then took up the mantle of being involved with forming the financial backbone of this institution and being sort of its patrons and guiding lights. And of course, Giuliano de' Medici and Lorenzo the Magnificent, his brother Lorenzo de' Medici. In fact, if my memory serves me well, they're even on the rolls in the archives of this building as at some point being one of the 12 men that would go along around it, actually. Whether they actually did it or not probably is up for debate, but at least they were enrolled in the fraternity, and there's evidence of that. My guess is probably either right before the Pazzi conspiracy or maybe right after. It was Lorenzo de' Medici and his circle. They would be the only ones that would have the money, right, to commission an artist. Of course, Ghirlandaio was working for that circle, whether it be the Sassetti Chapel in Santa Trinita or the Tornabuoni Chapel at Santa Maria Novella. It seems like the Buonuomini, the 12 good men, commissioned Ghirlandaio and his workshop to fresco the interior space of the oratory, the space that actually gave a public face to both the people that perhaps received charity on that site, but probably even more so the greater Florentine public. So we can go in now and check it out. So here's the space. It's really cool. You can see it's only a single nave. Beyond those doors there on the left and right would be the meeting places of the fraternity. And you can see it's vaulted ceiling, the vaults of the ceiling coming down to these capitelli. I can't remember what they're called in English. Corbels, maybe.
Corbels, corbels.
On the wall, forming these lunettes between the corbels. And here we can see this very interesting, at least to me, cycle of frescoes. It's definitely in the style of Ghirlandaio. Scholars suggest that the master Domenico Ghirlandaio actually painted the two frescoes that we're looking at above the altar table here, and that hands of his various apprentices did the rest. I feel like in some of them, perhaps Ghirlandaio may have been behind the compositions, though, in some of the other lunettes besides the two that we're looking at here, just because some, one or two of them are really exquisite. Besides the two that we'll discuss briefly that we're looking at, are really exquisitely done. So we're looking at the altar wall. This is right opposite that door that we would have walked through. And here you can see two lunettes that depict the life of Saint Martin and his role as a charity giver and like his mission, his charge. Of course, Saint Martin was living in a time of ancient Rome. He becomes a Christian convert, but he was a Roman soldier. I think he was even some sort of captain in the legions, if my memory serves me well. And he's stationed at the city of Arles in France. And there's this naked beggar outside the walls of the city. Everybody passes by this naked beggar, asks for alms, asks for clothing. And of course, nobody pays this beggar any mind or physically or verbally abuses this beggar. And one day, coming in from patrol, Saint Martin has pity in his heart. And what he does is he unsheathes his own sword, and you can see as he's riding his white horse, and he has that red cloak, his armor on, the walls of Arles on the left side of the fresco, and he slices his own, scarlet cloth in half, the cloth that identified you as an officer in the Roman legions, and you see him wrapping that naked beggar in that cloth. The next lunette up to the right of the altar there, we see what the conclusion of the story. But just that night in his barracks, Saint Martin falls asleep. You see his page sort of resting at the foot of his bed, and he has a vision or a dream in which Christ comes to him with this band of angels. And it was actually Christ that was that beggar, and Christ that's not where is now wearing the robe that he had rent in half with this gang of angels, pointing out his new servant, Saint Martin. Who would go on to be sort of like a soldier of Christ, right? And of the soul rather than of the Roman emperor, and thus the patron saint of charity givers. And appropriate to have each confraternity always had a patron saint who they would dedicate their charitable acts to and from whom they derive inspiration in a place at the pearly gates. Scholars suggest they're actually done by Domenico Ghirlandaio, which is something quite wonderful. Probably 1470s, some point, latest early 1480s. Love the loggia there on the right with the typical sort of Florentine, landscape and atmospheric perspective.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Renaissance people. If you are enjoying the Italian Renaissance podcast, I have good news. We're now active on Patreon. You can show your love for the show by becoming a patron and get access to additional resources, information, and artworks. Better yet, those who join the Renaissance Master or Renaissance Patron tier will get access to at least one additional podcast episode each month. My goal is to ensure that the main podcast remains a free, accessible source for everyone. Become a patron today through the link in the show notes to support the continued production of new episodes and help build and maintain this community. The Italian Renaissance Shop is now also active on Etsy, linked in the show notes. Sport our logo or choose from a growing selection of Italian art-inspired designs. Discounts are offered to select Patreon tiers as well. Your support has my immortal gratitude. Now, enjoy the show.
On a human scale, you walk in, you see these two stories, the figures aren't enormous, they're stuck into the lunettes. And if you're a person coming on the street, you really see the, at least in the 1470s or 80s, you see what the mission of the 12 good men of Saint Martin, right opposite of these two, which establishes the mission of the fraternity, you see beginning. And I like to think that the fresco cycle then continues across the entire length of the oratory, going back toward the back wall. Here you can see the beginning of the seven canonical works of mercy in the Gospel of St. Matthew. I'm sure most of you are familiar with that. It's Christ speaking to the apostles, saying, "Best way to earn your way into heaven is if you see me and I'm hungry, give me food. If you see me and I'm thirsty, quench my thirst. If I'm naked, clothe me. If I'm ill, bring me succor and visit me. If I'm in prison, come and give me aid and company. If I'm a stranger in a strange land, please give me shelter." A seventh one, those were six. A seventh one was added in the later, in the Middle Ages, which was also the proper burial, funeral rites for dead who, for those who were deceased who couldn't afford that. So we see these seven works of mercy, and each one is in the lunettes of the oratory. And I think it starts with this one here. So you can see the 12 good men, at least three of them in this picture, probably with one of their apprentices. They're dressed in the red and blue. There's one in the foreground. You can see pouring a pitcher of wine out into this woman's demijohn. You can see another one getting wine from this big, vast, almost looks like well or vat, filling up those jugs. And you could actually see another one of the confraternity members in the left background who's actually recording what's being given and to whom. In fact, there is evidence in the archives that there is always an official notary as one of the 12 good men so that they could do these services and make them legal for the fraternity. I think one of the cool things to look at in this painting is that the people receiving the charity here are women, or they're very young children, or a teenager, and that like political class that was exiled by the Medici is not present in the painting. So this one's cool. They sort of combine both feeding the poor and giving drink to the poor in one image. It's bread and wine, which of course, if you go back opposite to the altar table, this is where you see Christ revealing his wounds with the blood and his body, the bread, which is appropriate for the altar table that is right below it, to Saint Martin. And that connection is made to the sacred nature of giving charity, that it literally is Christ whom you are giving to the people for their sustenance, both religious sustenance as well as physical sustenance. And then, of course, the next fresco that you see is handing out swathes of linen to these poveri vergognosi. You see how we have a senior citizen over here on the right who actually has a cane. Not your standard sort of Renaissance picture in the Uffizi or the Pitti, right? Being supported by a woman as he's walking to see his charity. See these, even a baby, and it's sort of a little wrap there. And these probably what are adolescents collecting some of the clothes. There's always the notary right there recording who's getting the charity as it's being handed out. I love how this works going across the real space of the oratory. So you could look back and forth. That, of course, mirrors what's going on with Saint Martin when he slices his legionnaire's cloak and actually wraps the cold beggar in it. So an interesting way to make the viewer sort of look back and forth across the space and really connect what the 12 good men were dedicated to, the Gospel of Saint Matthew. That truly is what's going on the surface. But there is evidence in the archives that the Buonuomini actually did this, handed out linens when needed to dress these people, especially in winter. on feast days, especially to give handouts of wine, bread, and other foodstuffs to that community. So then, if you turn a little to the right, you see the rest of the seven acts of misericordia, of mercy. This one is, of course, giving succor to, giving aid to the sick. And you see these little glimpses, right, into a Florentine palace. You could tell they're not the poor. Look at the, or, well, not the lower classes, but they're poor. This raised bed with a little niches there in the background. One actually has a panel painting on the left, other with little objects in it. And you can see that the 12 good men actually may have brought a doctor, or maybe one of them is a doctor himself. Woman may have a broken arm or something. You see that he's wrapping it up to give her support. The fraternity member is standing behind the bed. And you can see the one in the kneel ground, in the foreground, kneeling, perhaps giving some nourishment to the little child that the woman, probably right after labor, is giving to this baby. In the front, another female of the household, or even a servant, you know, because they were part of that elite aspect of Florentine society before Cosimo throughout their menfolk. She's receiving a rooster, a capon, and a flask of wine, so to nourish her mistress, or maybe even her mom, back to health. So really lovely sort of vignettes. You see a composition like this in the paintings of the great masters of the 15th century, but it'd be, you know, the Virgin Mary after giving birth to Jesus, or it'd be Saint Elizabeth, John the Baptist's mom. Here you get a little glimpse into Florentines taking care of their own and into a household, normal person. If you go on to the next, you can see some of the other works of mercy. The one on the left, you see, I love this one because he's holding money bags here. You can see the balding, white-haired gentleman on the right in the red cloak. He's actually holding his money bags in the left hand. And what he's actually doing is perhaps paying off the debt of a Florentine who most likely was in debtor's prison, paying off his debt to the warden. The warden giving the fraternity member what looks like a sort of ticket or a little tessera, get out of jail free card, like in Monopoly. And you can see that the prisoner who is being released on the left is coming out and back into the light, while the other ones behind the bars there are pleading for the same kind of charity and checking out what's going on. Scholars have looked into sort of all kinds of cool curiosities with an image such as this, like the prisons to get out of them in the 15th century in Florence had these sort of low doorways that you'd have to actually bow and hunch yourself over to get out of as a sign of, you know, debasement and humility and penance and modesty once your sentence was commuted. It's all interesting takes. The next one, of course, is giving shelter to the stranger. Here you see another good man with his money bags, paying for perhaps a couple of nights at a hostel or a hotel. There you see the owner of the hostel collecting the money, dressed in white, and bringing in these religious pilgrims for a clean bed, fresh water to wash their faces. You see in the left background there to get a drink, probably on their way to Rome. You can see their pilgrimage badges on their hats. Probably have been to other sites. So another sort of insight. I can't remember not whether there's actual proof in the historical records if the 12 good men actually paid for pilgrimages to be put up in monasteries or hostels such as this one. But I wouldn't doubt it. But it could also be, of course, just an imagining of one of the seven works of mercy put into the late 15th century context of Medici in Florence. And then the last one, which is that one that was, I said, added later on, is really cool. And the lunette, here you can see once again.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Have you ever wondered what the band AC/DC has to do with the missing town of Doveland, Wisconsin? Or who gets to decide what music plays at the end of the world? Or whether or not the largest unsolved art heist in history was actually a cover for a different crime? Maybe you haven't wondered about these things, but that's okay. On 31, we dive into strange, true, but often lesser known stories and the interesting theories that surround them. From space to sports, lost media to internet lore, 31 has something for everyone. Find 31 on your favorite podcast platform and dive into the why behind the weird with me, Quinn Lovecraft. 31, the why behind the weird.
Mr. 12 Good Man giving his coins to a gravedigger. Gravedigger has just dug a hole in the ground. Obviously, he's not only paying for the tomb to be dug, but also paid for a simple mass, where you see these choir boys on the left singing that mass. Of course, this destitute person wouldn't have been able to afford that. And the Bonhomie are actually making sure that all souls are saved and are given their last rites and their funerary rites. You can see that sort of near the walls of the old city, which communal burial places would have been like at that time. But I think the most interesting and the frescoes that have the most resonance in this space, and they're still debated by scholars today, sort of what they mean, how they may intersect Florentine society, or how they may proactively construct the identity of the confraternity members and their role and their mission in society, are the two frescoed lunettes on the opposite side, starting with this one, which is sort of catty corner to the altar, the right altar wall, where St. Martin is having his vision. This painting offers something so different than the rest of Italian Renaissance art that you would teach in your survey class, right? The greatest hits. Here you obviously see the interior of a Florentine home, maybe even a palace. You can see that doorway there painted to look like it's Pietra Serena. That grand fireplace where one of the 12 good men is sitting on the bench, once with his little inkwell and his feather pen and his records, getting ready, or actually in the act of recording, what this woman in the center foreground is actually dictating. I find this so cool that the women here, with her expressive gestures, and with her clothing at the center point of the picture, really holds a place of primacy in this picture. The three-quarter sort of like pose. And dictating the scene. Behind her, you could see, perhaps in another room, maybe eavesdropping on what I would have to deduce is their mother, two younger women, one holding a spindle, which is bare. All three women, if you look closely, have holes that have been patched up in their gowns, but still nice gowns. At one time, they had money, perhaps. Their stockings, you can see, are ripped in their bare toes poking out of them. And that would, I think, make us conclude that the man standing at the right with the red cap and the blue tunic in the Venus Pudica pose, with his left hand over his breast and his right hand sort of by his waist, you know, a sign of humility and submission, thankfulness, gratitude. He too has holes in his stockings. So most likely is another, the father of the two females sort of whispering in the doorway, wondering what's happening. And most likely the husband, older husband of the woman in the foreground. No telling who the young boy may be, probably who's kneeling in the right foreground. Maybe an assistant to the 12 good men, sort of a page-like figure. Maybe a son of the households was helping lifting the top of this chest, wooden chest, that forms that sort of orthogonal there of the perspective grid, good part of the painting. Peering into it is one of the good men, in front of the father, who's looking with this sort of sad face of despair. What I think is going on here, at least for me, is you can sort of identify that chest on the right with a marriage cassone. Perhaps that's debatable because a lot of these things were used for storage. But of course, a woman, when they would get married, would have to go with their chest, full chest of their trousseau, with their monetary dowry. But if one of these poveri vergognosi family didn't have the means to do that, they couldn't marry off. There are two young ladies in this case who are standing in the other room, have proper attire, proper dresses, not just for the wedding day, but to be part of their respective groom's family. What I think is going on in this picture is that the female, the matriarch, is dictating to one of the 12 good men what exactly she's going to need, what the family is going to need to provide a proper trousseau and the proper accoutrement for a woman of decent social standing to be wedded to another family in the city. There's some debate about if that's what this scene is. I'm convinced you can sort of, the spindle that the young female is carrying in the back, sort of almost a yearning to have good clothes for male suitors, the whole family participating, even the child near the fireplace trying to keep warm. Really, this was one of the main charges of the 12 good men, and one of the things that Cosimo most feared would bring disgrace and disparagement on the city that he was the patriarch of, ruling on. And I think some scholars said, well, you can't really connect a lot of the frescoes in the space as a narrative of a story. I think you can. Some of the things that I just showed you, like going back and forth across the room between St. Martin's vision and the body, and the bread and wine being handed out as charity, of the slicing of St. Martin's cloak and that being established with giving out of linens of clothing the naked. So if you move to the right one, what we see would sort of be the logical conclusion of the 12 good men's task, which is a very rare and unique 15th century marriage scene. And the composition I really found fascinating in this one net, where the viewer is really instructed to focus on that sort of pinwheel of hands and read sort of the exchange and the social cement that the fraternity is bringing to their fellow citizens. And if you look, you can see the mother now gripping the left arm of one of the young women that were perhaps in that doorway. You see the father here. You have to say the faces are really similar. Of course, a lot of these are probably stock types, but this one seems to break that a little bit. You can see finally his stockings are mended as well. He looks appropriate for the occasion. And he's dragging forth his daughter's right wrist forward towards the groom on the opposite side of the sort of like triangular composition of figures. And as the bride's finger sort of moves across the composition, you see the right hand of the young, handsome, well-dressed suitor sort of extending the ring and actually slipping it on the finger of the young woman. So this wonderful sort of passing of the woman with the use of hands and this dynamism that, okay, is reaching out the hands, becoming the groom is slipping on the ring, but then look at the fraternity member in the middle. He's gripping his money pouch full of florins with his left hand. And you can see that his right hand has just removed some of those florins, is actually paying for the dowry and giving it directly to the groom, who's accepting the money. And at the moment that he accepts the dowry, only then is he slipping the ring onto the woman's finger. And you can see on the left, of course, there's another one of the good men who's drawing up the marriage contract. One of the things that's peculiar about this is there's no religious figure all consecrating the marriage. It's all done as a sort of financial and social contract to keep that aspect of Florentine society intact as it was undergoing these political and social revolutions at the end of the 1400s. And if this is sort of a post Pazzi conspiracy, I could see something like that being even important to Lorenzo the Magnificent, just as it was for his grandfather Cosimo in the, in the late 1430s, as he's seeking to shore up support among all aspects of Florentine society, when some ways was a tenuous reign. So yeah, so a little speed lecture about how, my whole goal in the previous, in part one of this podcast, was not to scare people off, although I want to tell the truth, and that you have to wear, you can't, it can never be undaunted. The minute you're daunted, you're gonna have a hard time. But if you do your legwork and you do your research and you invest your time, the city of Florence, despite it becoming super expensive, not having any appropriate housing for long-term professionals, all the problems that sort of follow along with that, still offers those sort of magical moments where you can get away from the maddening crowd and work your magic with your students, and give them something that they probably would definitely not get taking art history, or Renaissance Art History 101 back on the home campus.
Nero, thank you so much, everyone. I hope you got a good taste of what it would be like to be in Florence. To walk, you're not going to get that type of explanation walking into San Martino in Florence. You'll look around for a second. You'll say, "What is all this? It looks like there's a lot of guys taking notes," and then you'll walk out. But the reality is, what Nero was saying about the canon, it's a prescribed path that you're supposed to take, or told you're meant to take, where you can get just as much excitement and richness out of going the routes less traveled, which is where I really think you learn to engage the aspects of art that speak to you more directly.
Absolutely correct. And your administrators will want you to bring your students to go see, the highlights of the great names of the Florentine Renaissance while you're teaching there. But not only is this provide a break in something different, but works of art such as this work well with the students in terms of intellectual and art historical baggage. So now, if they came upon, Marriage of the Virgin Mary scene in the Louvre or in the Met in New York City, they would understand the composition immediately and understand sort of some of the dynamics that were that go into creating a Renaissance style painting such as that. So another one of my of, and I think a lot of lecturers on site do this, is provide the tools to your students, oftentimes rudimentary, but that's okay. On their free weekends, they're going to travel to Paris, to Amsterdam, to, and you'll be surprised, on their own, they're going to go and visit the museums without you there. And they're going to bring to bear some of the things that you taught almost organically and instinctively when they're visiting these other places without you instructing them. And so rewarding them when they come home from their weekend trip the next day in class, and they'll say, "I saw this and I understood what that meant in the Louvre or in Rijksmuseum or whatever." So I think that's one of the goals. Open doors. And most of your students will be, different majors than art history, but students like you from 2016 or going even back to 2005, they'll still be in touch with me saying, "Hey, do you remember that moment? Do you remember this? Give me your advice on that." And they'll be owning a car dealership or opening a restaurant or working as an accountant, something like that. And that makes all the difference.
Frank Nero, thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're welcome, and I hope to see you soon.
I do too. My dear
All right.
Renaissance people, make sure you follow us on Instagram, like us on Facebook, subscribe to the YouTube, and all the above. Until next time, arrivederci.
Ciao, ciao.